Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Caroline Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Christian. I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, understanding the different names for biomarker testing and their role in selecting the best treatment for you. And this is part two of the important role of biomarker testing in the treatment of cancer. What you need to know makes all the difference in the world. And today's program is supported by Mirati Therapeutics, Inc., Stemline Therapeutics, Inc., and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, before I introduce our speakers, I do want to go over with you a little bit about the call. So we have on the call today over 235 participants who come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, India, Nepal, the territory of Puerto Rico, Thailand, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call, and it's a pleasure to have all of you on this program today. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mark Criss. Dr. Criss is the William and Joy Rain Chair in Thoracic Oncology, Attending Physician, Thoracic Oncology Service, Department of Medicine, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell College. And Dr. Criss will be addressing overview of the different names for biomarker testing and why they can be helpful for treatment, the relationship between biomarker testing and precision medicine, and tumor marker testing, genomic profiling, genomic sequencing, molecular profiling, and next-generation sequencing. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Criss.
Okay, thank you, Carolyn. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today. I know some of you may have been on part one of this series, and do my best not to totally duplicate what we talked about before, but there are a few basic concepts I do want to go over once again, just so everybody hears these and they're in a good place to listen to the rest of the lecture. Again, the definition of a biomarker is that it's something that can be measured, and it is something that is a defining characteristic of the thing we're measuring, in this case, the cancer. So it really says something about exactly what we're dealing with looking at a biomarker. Again, a reminder that in 2024, there's only one way to diagnose cancer, and that is the removal of a piece of tissue from the cancer, piece of the cancer, or removal of a fluid in the body that was caused by the cancer, like a pleural effusion or a ascites peritoneal fluid. And that material is stained and looked at under the microscope by a pathologist or a cytologist. So no matter what kind of blood test you might have, no matter what the scan may show, that cannot diagnose cancer. These tests are very useful, by the way, but they're not useful in the diagnosis of cancer. It still goes to the pathologist. Now, after the pathologist says whether or not cancer is present, they immediately try to characterize further what they see under the microscope. What type of cell are they seeing? And the common names of cells are adenocarcinoma, squamous carcinoma, lymphoid or neuroendocrine carcinomas. You may hear those words. And in addition, by looking at those cancer cells, they can also impute what might be the site of origin of that cancer, the original place those cancer cells were taken from. So it's not always where the biopsy is done in the body. cancer, of example, of the colon can spread to the lungs. You biopsy the lung, and you don't find lung cancer there. You find colon cancer there, and that's something the pathologist can tell. It's super critical that that pathologist gets enough material to make that diagnosis and make it as precisely as possible. We hear a lot about biomarker testing, precision medicine, but the truth is the use of biomarkers is the way that the care is made most exactly. And the terms that have come out are precision medicine, personalized medicine, but the idea is you very, very carefully look at the cancer cell and look at characteristics of the cancer cell that define it and may also define its vulnerability. So that's really important in helping your doc choosing therapy. A reminder again, the first and most important issue is what the pathologist sees. That's how we diagnose cancer. That's generally how we diagnose what type of cancer it is, adenocarcinoma or squamous carcinoma. And lastly, also can give you ideas about the site of origin. The next step that is done as part of the analysis of the tissue or cells is what they call immunohistochemistry. What you look at is specific proteins that are present on the cancer cell that can help identify where the cell comes from and also vulnerabilities of the cancer cell. And I'll pick on sort of the big three that go across all the cancers. It would nowadays be PD-L1, whether or not there are characteristics that would point to the success of immune therapy. For breast cancers, the presence of the estrogen or progesterone receptor, ER or PR, and I think for prostate cancer, the presence of PSA, prostate-specific antigen, that define that. That's a test done on the tissue, and again done by the pathologist who's actually looking at the material. The next step is to take that material and then take extractions of it, take pieces of it. And the most common thing that's done today is when you have that piece of tissue, the DNA is extracted, and that DNA is put through a specific test of DNA. Now, those of you that saw Jurassic Park, you saw that they got DNA out of a dinosaur. And the reason, at least allegedly, that that can be done is that DNA is very stable. So the good thing about DNA is once it's there, it generally does not break down, and it can be extracted and analyzed. And if you do a DNA test and it shows the presence of a certain genetic change that defines the cancer, you can be absolutely sure that that change is there. It's very, very unlikely that there's a change in the DNA. There are very complicated, complex machines that do this, and the most common way this is done nowadays is you take the DNA, you put it into a analyzer, and it tells you dozens or hundreds of different kinds of mutations that are associated with cancer. And doctors use the presence or absence of those mutations to help generally define what the best treatment is going to be for that cancer. So all these terms, genomic profiling, sequencing, next generation sequencing, they all come from testing of the DNA. There is one other kind of test that's done, and that is using, I'll call it a panel. It's generally an RNA-based test. That too is done from tissue. And the most common one used, again, across cancers is the Oncotype, and very commonly used to help decide therapy for breast cancer. What's one common denominator to all these tests? It takes time. And in general, these tests are done in sequence. As I said before, the most important thing is to conclusively determine the presence of cancer, the type of cancer present, and its location. And that's done by the anatomic pathologist. And that comes first. And until that's done, this other testing generally is not started. The genomic testing, by its nature, and the review of the material that comes out of the sequencer by the pathologist takes 1 to 2 weeks. And it's not something that can be rushed. It's just exactly what it takes. And please remember, this is not just putting a specimen in a machine. The molecular pathologist carefully goes over those results and makes sure that they are relevant to that patient, that define that patient's cancer. So one question that comes up, is the time it takes to do these genetic tests worth it? And I would say absolutely so. It gives information that leads to the most precise and, in general, the best treatment that we have. And I urge you to work with your care team to try to see where you are, both physically and personally, in dealing with this delay, and make sure that it is medically acceptable to deal with the delay, and get that question out there. Don't fester saying, I can't stand this delay anymore. Make sure your team knows it and that they try to deal with it in the best way.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Chris. That was really an outstanding presentation. And you actually set the stage for today's program, so we thank you for that as well. Thank you. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kamal Abu Hussein. And Dr. Hussein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Department of Breast Medical Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center, Co-Director of the Janet Knowles Breast Cancer Program, Director of Breast Cancer Clinical Trials, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. And Dr. Hussein will be addressing types of biomarker tests for cancer treatment. Do I need biomarker testing for my cancer? And lastly, biomarkers used to show if a treatment is effective or may show if cancer is returning. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hussein.
Thank you so much for the nice introduction. I find this to be a very important topic in the world of breast cancer. As I always say, you know, breast cancer is really one of the earliest cancers that deployed the concept of precision medicine. So we have a molecular classification in breast cancer, which has a great impact on the prognosis of the disease and guiding treatment decisions. So we typically stain for hormone receptors, including estrogen and progesterone, which is the standard method for selecting patients for endocrine or hormonal therapy. So those are drugs like tamoxifen or another class of drugs called the aromatase inhibitors, including famous drugs like anastrozole, letrozole, and exemestane. And also we have a class of drugs called the selective estrogen receptor degraders or downregulators, and that includes also a well-known drug, an intramuscular injection type drug called Faslodex or fulvestrant. And now we have even oral forms that carry out the same function. And we have an FDA-approved drug called elacestrant. There are many other molecules similar to that drug that are being tested in clinical trials or still in development. The other protein that we uniformly test for, whether it's overexpressed on the surface of the breast cancer cell or not, is the human epidermal growth factor 2. This is also referred to as HER2, and that is very influential in dictating therapy with the anti-HER2-directed therapies. So I'm sure a lot of the listeners are familiar with medications like trastuzumab and pertuzumab, which are monoclonal antibodies against the HER2 receptor. There is another class that is very, very important right now, which are the antibody-drug conjugates, or the ADCs, and that is like Kadcyla, or another drug called Enhertu. And then there's a third class called the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and those are drugs like tucatinib, lapatinib, and neratinib, also very commonly used in HER2-positive breast cancer. Now, when it comes to our metastatic patients, we would order a test called next-generation sequencing, also known as NGS. The NGS panel is quite helpful in improving our understanding in identifying any targetable mutations, which could be used to change treatment and tailor it for every patient based on what that test shows. This could be performed on a tissue sample or a tissue biopsy, but it also can be accomplished by a blood sample, and we call this a liquid biopsy. Now, some of the important targets that have FDA-approved therapies include PIK3CA mutation. A drug that is approved for that is alpelisib or Piqray, which is typically combined with hormonal therapy for treatment of metastatic hormone receptor positive that carries that very mutation. There's also another drug that is being studied for the same mutation called inavolisib that has better tolerance. There's also a series of alterations, including three different points, and that is the PIK3CA, same mutation, and two other ones, including AKT1 and P10. And we've seen that patients that have any alteration in either of the three could be treated with a newly approved drug by the FDA called capivasertib or Truqap, and that is typically combined with fulvestrant. Now, with the continued exposure to the hormonal or the endocrine therapy with aromatase inhibitors in particular, there is an acquired mutation. That means a mutation that is acquired over time due to the exposure to a certain drug. And that could be detected in a good number of patients. Probably more than 50% of the patients can develop that. This mutation is in the ESR1. If this ESR1 mutation is present, there is an FDA-approved drug, which is a medicine called elacestrant or Orserdu, which was shown to be successful in controlling metastatic hormone receptor-positive breast cancer when used as a monotherapy. There are also less common targets, including the NTRK gene fusion, which are drivers in many solid tumors, including breast cancer. And even though they are present in less than 1% of all breast cancer cases, but they are present in the majority of a subset of breast cancer called secretory breast carcinomas. There is an FDA-approved therapy called entrectinib for patients that have that fusion. As my colleague was discussing the importance of genetic testing, this is something that is indicated for many breast cancer patients, and particularly the ones that are diagnosed at a young age or patients who have a relevant family or personal history for cancer, and also some patients that have certain ethnicities. All patients with triple negative breast cancer are also indicated to undergo genetic testing. And we do have a group of drugs called the PARP inhibitors. And the drugs that are approved are olaparib and talazoparib. They're different PARP inhibitors, and that is approved for patients who have a germline mutation in the BRCA gene. Programmed cell death or immune checkpoint inhibitors, and those are the drugs that are called PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors. A lot of them have been tested in the world of breast cancer in general, but the only one that has an FDA approval for the treatment of early stage and metastatic triple negative breast cancer is a drug called pembrolizumab, or known also as Keytruda. When we are following the response to treatment for metastatic breast cancer patients, we typically would follow the breast cancer tumor markers. And those are substances produced by the cancer cells or by the patient's body in response to the cancer. And those markers include CA15-3, CA27-29, and CEA. And, of course, now there is a lot of research that is focused on circulating tumor cells and circulating tumor DNA. And really, it's a very hot topic right now, and everybody wants to learn about that. But the story started more than a decade ago when researchers discovered that the tumor cells can break away from the tumor mass and could potentially circulate in the bloodstream. And they discovered that fragments of the tumor DNA or the ctDNA could also be detected in the blood, which was shown in a recent trial that this could be used as a biomarker in order to predict prognosis and recurrence in early stage hormone receptor positive and triple negative breast cancer. This was a group of patients on a larger study called the I-SPY 2 trial, which is a large trial that was testing targeted drugs in combination with standard chemotherapy. They specifically looked at a total of 283 patients, and those were patients that were receiving treatment preoperatively, and we refer to that in oncology as neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And they tried to assess if the ctDNA levels were different at certain points in time. They measured it at 4 points, before, during, and after this neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And they were able to see that if the ctDNA was no longer present in the patient's blood 3 weeks after starting the neoadjuvant chemotherapy for triple-negative breast cancer, the patients had a favorable response overall. They were also able to correlate longer-term outcomes with the presence or absence of the ctDNA after the patients would finish their neoadjuvant therapy. So the patients that had a positive result for ctDNA after treatment experienced reduced recurrence free survival, while those that were negative for ctDNA had better outcomes. I would say that the hope is that we can use these results from such studies to further clarify how can we use ctDNA as a biomarker to anticipate treatment response and survival outcomes in patients who have high-risk early-stage breast cancer who are receiving their neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So in other words, it is testing the concept to see if the patient who did not clear their ctDNA after 12 weeks from initiating therapy would maybe benefit from a change to another type of therapy and hopefully spare patients the side effects of chemotherapy when possible. So in closing, I think you can certainly appreciate the biomarkers' impact and how they completely dictate the way we approach every case with breast cancer. And over time, that influence or that impact is getting stronger, which hopefully will help us further individualize treatment protocols for every patient. I will stop here and back to you, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. That was just a wonderful presentation, stellar, just really comprehensive. And thank you so much for that, for all that information, which I know our participants really appreciate. And our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is lead on myeloproliferative neoplasms program, member of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor while Cornell Medicine. And Dr. Morrow will be addressing biomarkers play such an important role in choosing the best treatment for you and in determining your progress. Other uses of biomarkers determining a person's cancer risk or finding cancer. And some biomarker testing is done as part of clinical trials for new cancer treatments. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Morrow.
Thanks, Carolyn, and thanks for my colleagues for warming us up and everyone for joining. So as you can probably tell, we each have a bit of a certain focus with related to the kind of cancers we're treating. And I'm a leukemia physician. So I'd like to cover some of the questions that Carolyn has put forth, which are how biomarkers are determining treatment and prognosis, maybe risk, and even finding cancer, and how they're playing into clinical trials. So I will use leukemia as an example, but I want to keep it a little bit general so we can understand and really learn from this. So the first question is best treatment and determining prognosis. I'll use the example here of really any of the acute leukemias or even the chronic leukemias that we treat today. The story here is that we used to think of leukemias quite simply, how we could look at the blood counts or look at the disease down the microscope. Acute myeloid leukemia was probably the best example. So we would determine leukemia based on the type of cell that was being overproduced or that had been damaged. We really didn't understand very much about the damage. We then began to unravel it and saw certain genetic abnormalities that were visible in traditional tests, which have been available for many years. But as Dr. Chris explained, next generation sequencing and RNA and DNA panels really allowed us to completely unpackage leukemia and understand what genes are altered, what genes may be mutated, fused. And now we have classification for leukemia based on the genetic fingerprint. And this makes it a huge difference because we can then target treatment very precisely. We might have, for example, acute myeloid leukemia that has an excess of white blood cells that are general and they have some degree of differentiation. Now that kind of leukemia can be very risky and require certain treatments and could benefit from targeted treatments, or it might be a very good risk form of leukemia where it might have a, for example, favorable genetic fusion. And the names aren't less important, it's more the theory. So understanding this is these biomarker tests really help us fingerprint the enemy and understand what is likely to be helpful. It does affect prognosis, meaning, and we use prognosis as a gauge for what we need to do to try to achieve a cure. Sometimes we need to use just chemotherapy alone, for example, in acute leukemia, which is still strong and difficult. But sometimes we can use non-chemotherapy, as we call it, in certain diseases like acute lymphoblastic leukemia. I'll give an example there where it's acute lymphoblastic leukemia that harbors a genetic fusion called the Philadelphia chromosome can now be treated with different modalities of therapy, which really don't involve chemotherapy any longer. They involve targeted therapies called BCR-ABL inhibitors or TKIs and steroids and antibody drugs, and the most prominent one being a drug called blinatumomab. So biomarkers really do help us understand, you know, kind of profile the enemy, as I like to say, right from the beginning. One last paradigm to share biomarkers, and this is a little bit more of a workhorse biomarker. Again, I look after a lot of patients with chronic myeloid leukemia, and that disease is really the first human cancer that was linked to a genetic abnormality. And I think biomarkers probably fair, but it's probably more of a historic cytogenetic and DNA RNA-based finding. BCR-ABL can be measured in many different ways. That becomes the sole focus when we treat chronic myeloid leukemia. We can determine the level at the beginning. We can measure treatment response very easily with blood-based testing at, say, three-month intervals. We now are able to de-emphasize tests such as bone marrow studies. And we can see mutations in that biomarker or that finding, that fusion that determine drug sensitivity. We can risk stratify people based on the nuances of that biomarker. So CML, again, as one of the most prominent diseases that has a distinct genetic abnormality, has really shown us, I guess, a little bit of the roadmap on how to use a biomarker best. The second point was about a cancer risk or finding a cancer. So biomarkers can be useful, and I'll give to see potentially the risk of a cancer that may be coming or of someone's risk of cancer. And one clear example would be something called clonal hematopoiesis. So in recent years, we've really seen that patients with other cancer treatments, maybe prior risk factors, may have genetic changes in their blood, which aren't necessarily a blood cancer yet, but may lead to some changes in their blood counts and may ultimately lead to a cancer risk. So using next-generation sequencing, we determine in a patient perhaps who has no blood count changes that they may subsequently have a blood cancer, or in patients that might have some minor changes in their blood, what the risk of them evolving to leukemia might be. Very important. So there's another way we've using biomarkers. And last, and I think not least, is how do we determine the role of biomarkers in clinical trials and new cancer treatments? That's really where the magic lies, because we now have clinical trials where we don't characterize the cancer just based on where it is and where it's gone or where it might not have gone, thank goodness. What is the genetic fingerprint? And there are many trials in many different cancers where the input is, take a sample of the tissue, as Dr. Chris said, whether it's blood or a biopsy, and you profile that, and then you determine the treatment from there. And you're able to quickly identify targets, lesions in the genetic code or in the molecular landscape that will tell you which medicine will match with this patient. That is the ultimate personalized medicine, where a tumor can be quickly clarified through biomarkers to help us understand what is going to be the most successful treatment. And there can be vast differences in treatment. And you wouldn't want to try something general first and then go to a targeted treatment. You might want to do this first, of course. So you have the highest yield, the best outcome, and the lowest side effects potentially. So maybe to catch us up on time and to just close here with, for me, I think leukemia has really given us a lot of insight into biomarkers, and they're clearly useful across the board to help us navigate, to help us diagnose, and to help us pick clinical trial choices.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Moore. That was an outstanding presentation, really stellar, and just fantastic. So thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Sarah Kerr, and Dr. Sarah Kerr. And Dr. Kerr is pathologist, Hospital Pathology Associates, Division of Cytopathology, Pulmonary Gynecologic and Molecular Pathology, Allina Health Laboratories, Allina Health Cancer Institute. And Dr. Kerr will be addressing the role of the pathologist. Samples are sent to the lab where pathologists test for certain biomarkers, how biomarker testing is done, using samples of your cancer and your healthy cells, and also we'll be addressing some results might lead to genetic testing, inherited or germline mutations. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kerr.
Well, hello, everyone. It's so great to be part of this program today. Thank you so much. You've gotten some really great information about biomarkers from the oncologist speakers. And my job today is to tell you about pathologists. So pathologists also play a very important role in your cancer care team. And I'm so excited to describe exactly what goes on behind the scenes in the laboratory for biomarkers tested for by laboratory professionals. Now, I'm going to repeat some of the material from the prior speakers, but this is sort of from a laboratory or a pathologist perspective, so hopefully you'll get a sort of a new angle on it. So first of all, what is a pathologist and how are they involved in biomarkers? So a pathologist is a physician who leads a laboratory and is ultimately responsible for all of the biomarker test results. We work closely with the rest of your care team to make sure that your cancer diagnosis is as accurate and specific as possible, because that pathology report of tumor type, grade, stage, those are really the first steps in biomarker testing. The biomarkers that you need for your cancer are first chosen based on the primary site of the cancer. So for example, breast cancer or lung or colon or bladder cancer or blood cancer. The subtype of the cancer, like adenocarcinoma or small cell carcinoma. And then also the stage is important. So is the disease confined to an organ or spread to lymph nodes or beyond? Those characteristics of a cancer that a pathologist determines by examining the tissue under a microscope really determine which biomarker tests are important to know. So for example, in breast cancer, as one of the prior speakers had explained, hormone receptors, ER and PR, and the biomarker HER2 are performed on virtually all breast cancers. But in something like lung cancer, those biomarkers are really not important at all, and instead, mutation testing is needed for non-small cell carcinoma that has spread to help determine the best therapy. Now, a biomarker like PD-L1, which is an immunostain, might be needed for both lung and breast cancer, but the scoring system for that stain, as far as positive or negative, is very different depending on if the tumor is lung or breast cancer. So that pathology diagnosis is really the most important biomarker that determines what other biomarkers are needed. Okay, second, so how does a pathologist test for biomarkers? The tissue that comes to the laboratory for diagnosis is most commonly used for biomarker testing. That tissue that comes to the laboratory, either from a small biopsy or a surgery, is processed into wax-embedded or paraffin-embedded blocks that are preserved for many years to be used in the future if needed. And the DNA within that tissue is very stable once it's preserved in that way. The first type of biomarker test I will describe is something called immunohistochemistry, or immunostains. For immunohistochemistry, the tissue in the wax blocks is cut into very thin sections on a glass slide, and then a stain is applied to that thin section that is made up of something called antibodies that are designed to detect a biomarker protein in the cancer tissue. So when those antibodies in the stain bind to that biomarker, it makes a color that is visible to the pathologist under a microscope. And sometimes we just give sort of an estimate based on our own eyes and brain, and sometimes we use a computer to help us figure out exactly how much of the biomarker is there in terms of how dark the stain is or what percentage of the cancer cells are staining for that biomarker. So, for example, in ER or PR testing in breast cancer, we use a computer often to tell us how many of the cells are there that express ER or PR and how intense that staining is. And those numbers help your oncologist figure out if you're likely to respond to those hormone-blocking medicines that were described. For a biomarker like mismatch repair enzymes in a tumor, the concept is a little bit different. So we're still looking at a stain, but we're actually looking under a microscope to see if the cancer has lost the ability to produce the protein in the cancer cells compared to your healthy cells. So mismatch repair deficiency is a biomarker that can predict if you could respond to immune checkpoint inhibitors or immunotherapy because it predicts whether the cancer cells that have mismatch repair deficiency accumulate mutations that result in proteins in the cancer that are different than your healthy cells, and your immune system can be ramped up by that immunotherapy to recognize those differences in the cancer cells. So we also look at cancer cells and sometimes the immune cells around the cancer cells in the tissue to see if they are positive for that biomarker called PD-L1, which is a biomarker for immunotherapy as well. So basically the PD-L1 pathway in the cancer is helping the cancer cells hide from the immune system, and the immunotherapy helps turn off that mechanism of hiding from your immune system, and we can look for that biomarker in the tissue with that PD-L1 stain. So there are a variety of immunostains that are biomarkers, and a pathologist checks for those under a microscope, sometimes with the help of a computer to give a number. Another similar method to immunostains that you might see tested for in your cancer is in situ hybridization, or what is called FISH, or fluorescence in situ hybridization. And just like those immunostains, special probes are applied to those thin slices of wax-embedded tissue on glass slides, but this time the stain is targeting the DNA rather than proteins. And FISH can be used to detect the number of copies of a gene, like HER2, or can be used to detect rearrangements in the DNA, like a gene called ALK, where when it's rearranged, it becomes overactive. And the laboratory looks at these FISH results under a microscope to look at how many copies of a gene are present or if the material is fused in an abnormal way. And then the last type of biomarker I will describe involves molecular testing, which you've heard is usually these days by next-generation sequencing, or NGS for short. So NGS is a way to test cancer cells for changes in the DNA code of the cancer cells. And we look for mutation biomarkers like EGFR or BRAF or PIK3CA mutations using NGS. NGS can also be used to detect those fusion biomarkers like we do for FISH, but with just a different method. So ALK or ROS1 fusions can be detected also by NGS. And we can also look to see if there are too many copies of a gene like we would with a stain, but this way, in this method, we use NGS for genes like HER2 or MET, or some genes that we look at for too many copies, or what we call amplification. And all of these changes in a cancer can be detected by NGS by looking at those many different genes at once, sometimes hundreds. And for NGS, a lot of data is generated by those sequencing instruments, which is compiled by a computer to help the laboratory and the pathologist make a report of all the changes. And we review those to make sure that what the computer is generating makes sense. For that NGS, we can use that wax-embedded tissue like we do for the stains, or sometimes we use cancer cells that are preserved in some other way, like a fine needle aspirate specimen on cytology slides that are stained and used for diagnosis. Sometimes we can repurpose those for next generation sequencing. NGS can also be done on genetic material that's shed from a cancer into the blood, which is sometimes called liquid biopsy or circulating tumor DNA. And sometimes we also test the cancer cells by NGS in parallel with your healthy cells to compare them. And this helps us determine what is different in the cancer versus your healthy cells. And when we do that, sometimes we might find mutations that are either in the cancer and healthy cells that might tell us that you have some inherited change in your DNA that could predispose to you developing cancer, your family members developing cancer. And so you might be referred to a genetic counselor to talk about those findings. So this brings me to the difference between biomarker testing in cancer cells and in healthy cells, because we can get information from both. As I mentioned previously, the biomarker testing in the cancer tells us what's different in the cancer versus your healthy cells, so your oncologist can choose drugs that are designed to target the cancer and leave your healthy cells alone, maybe predict if something general like chemotherapy or radiation would be more helpful than targeted therapy. Sometimes we want to know what is unique about your inherited genes or the changes in the DNA that run in your family, because these changes can help your cancer team understand if they can prevent you or your loved ones from getting additional cancers. So usually when you have a familial cancer syndrome where cancer runs in your family due to a specific gene mutation, the first mutation can be identified in your healthy blood cells or your saliva, and your cells generally have two copies of those genes. So another mutation is required to happen spontaneously to actually develop the cancer. So some cancer syndromes that you might have heard of are like BRCA-associated or breast and ovarian cancer syndromes, Lynch syndrome, Li-Farmani syndrome. These are all what we call autosomal dominant inherited syndromes, meaning that one copy of the gene is passed down from a parent to a child with that mutation. And interestingly, having a familial cancer might also predict whether you could respond to a specific type of cancer therapy. So knowing that you have a familial cancer syndrome could also prevent more cancers in your family by having surgeries to remove what would otherwise be healthy tissues where cancer might start, like fallopian tubes or ovaries or breast tissue or thyroid tissue, before a cancer starts. So that information usually comes from testing your healthy cells in addition to potentially testing tumor tissue for mutations. So that's all I have for today. Thanks so much for listening in, and I'm turning this back over to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. That was really outstanding, just a wonderful presentation, and really helping our participants understand the very significant role that pathologists play in the treatment and diagnosing of cancer. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Amelia Calvarese. And Dr. Calvarese is a molecular pathologist, associate staff, section of molecular pathology, laboratory medicine, Cleveland Clinic, member, patient engagement subcommittee, Association of Molecular Pathology, AMP. And I should say that we are partnering today with AMP, with the Association of Molecular Pathology, and we are delighted to have Dr. Calvarese with us today. And she'll be discussing the Association of Molecular Pathology, AMP, three programs and services, and how to contact them. A very unique and wonderful organization, so I'm going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Calvarese.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. So hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you today. As Carolyn mentioned, my name is Dr. Amelia Calvarese, and I'm a practicing molecular pathologist at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio. And for the past 4 years, I've also been a member of the Professional Relations Committee at the Association for Molecular Pathology, AMP, as well as a member of the Patient Engagement Working Group at AMP. And today I've been asked to talk to you about AMP and all of our free resources and programs for patients. AMP is a nonprofit organization founded in 1995, which has around 2,900 members, many of whom are practicing physicians and molecular professionals who develop, perform, and interpret genetic testing for many human diseases, including cancer. AMP members influence policy and regulation on the national and international levels, ultimately serving to advance innovation in the field and protect patient access to high-quality, appropriate testing, and to advocate for improved insurance coverage for these crucial tests. Our mission is to advance the clinical practice, science, and excellence of molecular and genomic laboratory medicine through education, innovation, and advocacy to enable the highest quality of healthcare. You may have previously heard about AMP as we were the lead plaintiff on a landmark United States Supreme Court case back in 2013, AMP versus Myriad Genetics. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously in favor of AMP and our co-plaintiffs that naturally occurring DNA sequences, even when isolated from the body, cannot be patented. From a patient advocacy perspective, this ruling was a victory for making genetic testing more accessible. Prior to this case, Myriad Genetics held exclusive rights to isolate an individual's DNA and sequence the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, in which certain inherited variants can predispose patients to developing various tumors, including breast and ovarian cancers. Before the Supreme Court ruling, many other companies and organizations also held patent rights over other genes. This exclusivity limited patient access to potentially life-saving genetic and biomarker testing, and the Supreme Court ruling opened the door for other laboratories to provide testing services, increasing accessibility and reducing costs. But it's also important to note that while this ruling was a significant step forward, there are still many barriers to overcome in making genetic testing truly accessible to all patients, which is why AMP continues to advocate on behalf of patients. So as part of my work on the AMP Patient Engagement Working Group alongside fantastic staff at AMP, we work closely with the patient advocacy groups to sponsor lunch and learns and educational workshops like this one. We also develop online resources to help patients understand their molecular testing and what happens behind the scenes in a molecular laboratory. Before I became a doctor myself, I remember thinking of the laboratory as a black box where my sample goes in one end and the result comes out the other end, often written in a complicated language that I didn't understand at the time. I'm the only doctor in my family, and so when my dad was diagnosed with cancer in 2022, I got so many questions from my family. I was very fortunate that I had the skills and expertise to interpret and translate my dad's pathology and molecular reports for him, but I know that most people don't have that luxury. So a few years ago, the AMP Patient Engagement Work Group launched a patient outreach website, which you can find at outreach.amp.org, that provides educational information in a clear, easy-to-understand way. If you go to outreach.amp.org, you'll find written content, infographics, and videos about what happens in a molecular diagnostic lab, in addition to descriptions of types of molecular tests, such as DNA sequencing, frequently asked questions, and frequently updated educational resources. We're also working on translating our content into Spanish. Specifically for cancer patients and their families, we have an infographic on screening versus diagnostic testing for breast cancer, as well as an informational article on cancer genetics, genetic testing for cancer, and disease-specific biomarkers at outreach.amp.org/resources/cancer. We invite you to look it over, and please feel free to contact us with any suggestions for additional material. With that, I'll turn the seminar back over to Caroline, and thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Calvarisi. That was just a wonderful presentation, and I think for all of you on the call today, please do visit the Association of Molecular Pathology website. They have wonderful materials for the public to understand more about biomarkers, so that's really important. So please do that. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services. I'm going to go right then into the Q&A, so please do have your questions ready. I'm going to go over with you just the free services and programs that Cancer Care offers. So Cancer Care, many people call our HOPE line, which is 1-800-813-4673, and speak to a social worker when they call. Social workers are in queue, about 40 of them, and they will take turns answering questions, so you don't really have to wait to speak to someone. And people often ask questions about financial questions or transportation, and they will answer that question. Then they will go over with them all the services we offer. So what are those services? We offer free support services. We offer financial assistance. We offer co-payment assistance, and also assistance for people who may have a pet but aren't able to afford the food for the pet, or aren't able to walk their dog, or are not able to change the litter box. And so we do offer those services as well. So just very practical and financial resources. We also offer resource navigation. So if we don't have the resource you need, like let's say it's about food insecurity, we will then connect you and work with you. That team will work with you and stay with you until that resource is gotten for you. So either it would be in your city, in your region, in your state, or in the country, a national program. We also have a number of online support groups for all different types of cancer, and for both older adults, younger adults, middle-aged adults, caregivers, LGBTQ community. We really have online support groups for everyone. And if you go to our website, www.cancercare.org, you'll be able to see all the different resources we offer. We do offer these educational programs, about 80 a year. We do have a lot of different publications, again, listed on our website that you can download. And we also have a coping circle support as well. So that gives you just a thumbnail sketch of all the services that we offer. And now we're going to go right on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Krista to explain to you how to ask a question online. Krista?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So is a liquid biopsy, this is for Dr. Kurt, is a liquid biopsy accurate in leukemia if very little lymphocytes are there? Can biomarkers go away after treatment?
Sure. For blood cancers, you know, liquid biopsy kind of is the predominant specimen source because that captures the cells in your blood. And yes, it is accurate. Generally, in my lab, we test for variants that are 5% frequency or more. So all overt leukemias will definitely have genetic variations at 5% or more. And it is, with successful treatment, these biomarkers, you know, will be, in terms of, you know, particular mutations, we do expect them to be eradicated, and we have some very sensitive molecular tests for certain biomarkers for leukemias that we can use to measure very, very low levels very exactly.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question, thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Kerr. If a metastatic person had genomic testing when she became stage 4, and after being on treatment, it progresses, should the person get genomic testing again to see if the tumor mutated?
That's a really great question. So it kind of depends on what target you're looking for. So there are many driver mutations that are present in a cancer that stay in the cancer even during treatment and are very stable. And so for those types of biomarkers, we can look at either the tumor before or after treatment. But there are other biomarkers. One that was mentioned today was ESR1 in breast cancer. There are also resistance mutations during leukemia treatment or during lung cancer treatment that can pop up after treatment as a sort of a resistance mechanism to the treatment. I think of it sort of in the same way as I think of if you have an infection, like a bacterial infection, and you receive antibiotics, sometimes that infection will become resistant to the treatment and you need to switch treatments. And in the same way, we can use biomarkers for cancer after treatment to see if the cancer has picked up one of those resistance mutations to treatment so that we know to switch you to a different treatment that's designed for that resistance. And so it depends on what you're looking for, but often oncologists prefer to retest the cancer after treatment so that we have a fuller picture of both those driver mutations that were there at the beginning and then how those mutations have changed during treatment so they know whether to switch you to a different treatment.
Excellent, thank you. And this is a question for Dr. Calparese. Do you know of any services or resources that can help patients reach clinical trials that match their diagnosis and molecular profile?
That's a great question. So I know that NIH has a central repository of clinical trials, and often this is work that gets done behind the scenes at molecular tumor boards at, you know, various academic institutions. So there's a number of National Comprehensive Cancer Network, NCCN, aligned cancer treatment centers, and all of them have tumor boards as well as, community cancer hospitals. And so that's when a team of experts, oncologists, pathologists, geneticists all can get together and do their best to match patients to clinical trials as well.
Excellent, thank you. And a question for Dr. Kerr. Is liquid biopsy useful for solid tumors?
Yeah, so I'll answer that in sort of a general way. So in solid tumors, I'll use the example of lung cancer, where we're starting to get a better understanding of that. So in lung cancer, we still prefer to have tissue to make sure that we're getting all the mutations that are there in the cancer, but sometimes we just can't get enough cells for testing. And so one of the uses of liquid biopsy is to see if there are mutations, especially in advanced cancer patients, mutations that we can detect in the blood that are predictive. And laboratories have come up with ways of measuring if they think that they're getting DNA from the tumor versus your healthy cells in the blood, and so they can predict with some accuracy whether or not the blood is an adequate specimen versus the tumor. And then sometimes we're doing them in parallel in lung cancer, so we're actually testing the tumor tissue and then we're testing what's going on in the blood and comparing them. And some studies have shown that there's you get a fuller picture by doing those in parallel. So it's still sort of early in solid tumors as far as liquid biopsy, but it's definitely evolving fast, and we're finding really great ways of incorporating that blood testing in comparison to the solid tumor testing for a number of reasons. So ask your oncologist about that.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm going to we're just going to have a takeaway from Dr. Kerr and Dr. Calvarese. Just a minute or minute and a half takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program. I'm going to start with Dr. Kerr.
Sure. So what I always tell patients about biomarkers is, especially if, you know, you might move between different healthcare systems that might not communicate with each other, it's sort of hard to keep track of your biomarker records if you, say, winter in Arizona and do your summers up north. Try to keep track of those records either electronically or on paper so that all of your doctors have access to those. It becomes very important, you know, maybe years down the line when your cancer has gone into remission and then you have, you know, maybe a nodule that pops up somewhere on a scan that gets biopsied. It's really important for your pathologist to know what your prior diagnosis was and what the biomarkers were and whether they need to repeat those based on what your prior diagnosis was. So try to keep track of those records. I know it's can be a lot of stress to stay organized, but try to keep those paper records or electronic records so that all of your doctors know your medical information, especially if you move between healthcare systems.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Kerr. And Dr. Calvarese?
Yeah, I would echo Dr. Kerr's excellent point about keeping track of your records. You know, especially if you're in remission now and hopefully your cancer never comes back. But, you know, in the case that it does, having accurate documentation. Yeah, nothing really else to add.
Okay, thank you so much. I want to thank our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants also who asked such great questions. That allows us to kind of further discuss issues that are of concern to you. Now, I do want to acknowledge that we have many more questions in queue that we were able to take. So I'd like to make some comments about that. For those of you who were able to ask a question, for those of you who have a question in queue, and for those of you who have a question you might like to ask, I recommend that you all go back to your treating healthcare team with the question that you have in mind. Remember, they, of course, know you the best. They have your records in front of them. And be sure to ask your questions of your healthcare team. Remember, your healthcare team consists of many different people, and it includes your oncologist, your radiation oncologist, pathologist, oncology nurse, oncology social worker, financial specialist, financial navigator, resource navigator. So a lot of people on that team. So even though you may be meeting with your oncologist, you may ask a question and they may refer you to someone on that team to help you. And also, you certainly have the resources of the Association of Molecular Pathology. You'll be receiving a SurveyMonkey evaluation this week. In the meta-evaluation, we will include information that we gave you today, like websites and things like that, and phone numbers so you can contact them. I have to say that AMP, the Association of Molecular Pathology, has a wonderful patient section. It's just really fantastic and really breaks down for you a lot of what we talked about today, but in such great detail. So I would definitely recommend that you utilize them. You certainly can call Cancer Care, our Hope Line, and speak to our social workers there as well. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I would not want any one of you to feel you're alone. I want you to know you're now part of a community of support, and we're all here to help you. So I want to thank you all for your participation, and I wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Have a great day.